So here we are at the beginning of what would be the seventh week of the class, I think.
Yep.
Well, we're not going by topics anymore because the topics are seeming all to last 2 weeks. Which is, I'm happy with just letting things take as long as they need to take. Last week's, we started catching saying in the act, that bought off chapter, which in a way, it is the centre of the whole course, what he's talking about in that chapter, which is the phenomenon of language. I know not all of you have done the Introduction to Phenomenology course, but this is Philosophy of Consciousness, which is a kind of overarching title for everything that I teach, is really about phenomenology. The phenomenology philosophically is the kind of core of it, which is fundamentally about having some form of direct experiential access to whatever it is that we're looking at. And in this course, it's language. So a phenomenology isn't about having a theory of what language is. It's about, in a certain sense, having an immediate glimpse or intuition or sense of the being of language. And if you get that, that's it. And of course, language is a great, almost fundamental, because all of phenomenology as philosophy is expressed in language. So you can't really overlook language. Yes, in phenomenology, you can't overlook it, because everything that you say, in a way, is in language. And that's the means that we have to express what phenomenology is. And if we do that without having an idea, and not an abstract idea, but a grasp of the phenomenon of language itself, then we don't know what we're doing. But in a way, we don't know what we're doing anyway.
Can I ask something, John?
Yes.
When phenomenologists talk about language, are they talking about only spoken languages like English and so forth, or would they include mathematics, computer languages, any system of that sort?
Let's say computer language and mathematics, which, if we get time, we will look at, is a kind of a derivative form of what we're looking at as being primarily what language is. So, and we've been, and there's no direct answer to that, because in a way, what phenomenology says if you want to know what language is, you have to look into language. There's not like an answer on the board. And we've been attempting to, if you like, sketch a background by saying, how must it have emerged? You know, so part of that question really would be, there's a blurry area there, isn't there, where language, we could say, was emerging out of something like singing, and where did the sort of the noises that we were making to each other, expressive noises, become language? That's sort of lost in the sort of layers of our own consciousness. It's a strange thing, because in a way we're talking about our ability and that's even the wrong way of putting it. Language is in us; it's manifesting in us. And if you like, phenomenology is a matter of looking into that manifesting of language, rather than learning some kind of body of knowledge about this is what language is. Because quite often you might think at the end of doing a course with me, you know, what did I learn? And well, I don't know. I don't know. Because if you get anything from doing a course like this, it'll happen in a moment where you see something, and then if you like, your reflective mind will come back later and say, well, what did I learn? And there's a sense in which we've been dancing around this, that part of our intelligence that wants to reflect and fix things can't really grasp what we're after. So it will tend to look back on what goes on in a class and think, well, I don't know, nothing happened. Do you know? And whereas there are other kinds of classes that you can do where, yeah, we are giving you a systematic set of facts and knowledge that are all interrelated, and at the end of it all, you've got a kind of a knowledge possession. Whereas the phenomenon of language isn't something that you can possess that way.
One question. It's because sometimes we are speaking about language, but many times when somebody tells you something, it's not that there are something non-verbal that he wants to or she wants to tell, but give you another, make another phrase, but she's not, or he's not thinking really in that, but in another situation. For example, it's a stupid example. I send you an email, and we meet 2 weeks later, and you tell me why you sent me an email. And that is not really the thing that you wanted to tell me, but you wanted to tell me maybe another thing about our relationship. But I tell you, you tell me why you sent me the email, or I haven't had time to review your email, but it's not that thing that I want to tell you, but I want to tell you, or you want to tell me, I don't want to have this relationship, for example. Something like that.
Yes.
You see?
Yes.
We are speaking about this here because language is very complicated. Something that you tell is not really what you want to tell. Did you see?
Yes. And we are, when we were talking about meaning and the unsaid, and that everything you say, the unsaid is with it. It's not something like you forgot to say the unsaid. It's like the phenomenon of language is the said and the unsaid together. Yes? So it's when we tend to focus, when we think about it, purely on what's said and say that that's language. But language is the manifestation of meaning, and the manifestation of meaning is more than what is said. And it's what you were saying is, and sometimes it even contradicts what's said. Yeah, but if you grasp, there's always the unsaid, which is the context out of which what is said, it has its meaning. So it's always got this hidden aspect. And that's, I was talking last week about the distinction between how, say, analytic philosophy works with language and how we're working with language. Analytic philosophy tends to be, Wittgenstein is the philosopher who crossed the line. If you've heard of Wittgenstein, he sort of started off as an analytic philosopher and then crossed the line into Wittgenstein land. He's probably the most fascinating of that group of philosophers. If you can follow him from the Tractatus, which was his first kind of work of logic, into his philosophical investigations, which is after the Second World War, he kind of saw that whole approach of trying to understand logic and language as being somehow equivalent doesn't work, because logic only looks at what's explicit. Yes, it only looks at the said and not the unsaid. And people who tend towards analytic philosophy generally tend towards looking for precision. It's all about precision. And if you see... I'm sort of dancing around your question. Precision is a possibility of language. You see, it's not that that's wrong. It's precision is a possibility of language. But it's all a matter of getting it into perspective. It's because people, analytic philosophers who are... I don't want to characterise every analytic philosopher, because there's a great range of people in analytic philosophy. The tendency there is to think that what language, natural language, is a failure to be precise. Do you ultimately language ought to be this utterly, utterly precise, everything said with an absolutely clear sense of what it refers to. And we down here are in an imprecision of natural language because we haven't been able to make what we say precise enough. Whereas a phenomenological understanding says, no, it's in, you, that's not the nature of language. Language has got its own extraordinary intelligence and capacity to express what can't be said precisely. It's a big...
Or doesn't need to. Or kind of, it's kind of almost like doing away with precision as a goal to start with.
Yes, yes.
As a conscious kind of thing.
But we're in the... we're sort of living... The thing about philosophical ideas is, at one level you think, oh, well, that's interesting. It's all going on in some academic department somewhere. But there's a certain... as I keep coming back to, that analytic view of language is being worked out now in computer technology. Because a computer has no consciousness of the unsaid. Yeah, so if a computer is going to be able in any way to interact with us... in a way that's convincing, it's going to be a kind of a proof from that side of analytic philosophy that language can be made precise. That really, ultimately, there's a precise language that we poor humans are failing to, because we're not, you know, we can't process information fast enough. We're not able to assimilate the precise language. If a computer can generate natural language using precise rules, then that's a kind of a proof that there really is a precise language. It's the precise language that the computer programmer has programmed into the computer. So do you see that this whole argument that I'm discussing is actually going to be worked out in our technology, and we're going to end up in a world, you know, if it survives long enough and in the direction that it's going, where we're going to be encountering this question directly.
Isn't this search for precision an example of what I call quantophrenia, which is the obsession with quantifying everything and trying to quantify the unquantifiable? I mean, you see it in... You see it in professions, for instance. I mean, when I started teaching, when you marked an essay, you wrote to the student what was good about the essay, what could have been improved, how it could have been improved, and then you kind of just gave it a rough kind of grade. But now it's kind of like you have to search through the essay and say, you know, what level for each criteria, and you have to quantify everything. And a lot of what they're asking you to quantify isn't quantifiable, because it's about It's about progress, it's about understanding, it's about a lot of other things.
Yes, it's about the entire context.
The context in
that you have in your own mind, really, about knowing that person, and knowing what the question that you set, knowing how they've responded, knowing what you said, what you've taught, and the whole thing gets put into a marking schema that can't capture the depth of your own understanding, and then you have to work according to something that's less intelligent than you are. And not only that, you have to, you know, it's almost like some kind of horrible torture, where you have to write your own marking schema even. You know, it's like a horrible...
Yeah.
It's like there's a madness in it. But the quantophrenia that you called it, there's a sort of a question there that says, is the entire universe a kind of machine? You know, and there's an answer to that question. And if the entire universe is a kind of machine, then it's everything that occurs here, in a certain sense, is a result of the interaction of a whole something that can ultimately be expressed mathematically. Now, I've gone up again, and there's a fundamental thing there, that where people who take that worldview are really saying, well, yes, that's how it is. It's as physics says. You know, the Schrödinger wave equations essentially determine what happens at the quantum level, and everything else is determinable from that. And if that is how it is here, then in a way, the quantophrenia view of things is correct. That finally comes down to, does our being conscious make a difference? The kind of question that hovers over this whole computational area is something like that. Does our being conscious change anything in this behaviour of what we call the material universe? And if it does, if you can demonstrate just one instance where consciousness makes a difference, then the entire quantophrenia world disintegrates.
And don't electrons change their behaviour when they're being observed?
We're recording.
Yeah, this is incredible.
So the don't electrons change their behaviour when they're observed? It depends. Yes, they do, but it depends what you mean by observed. Do electrons change their behaviour when impinged on by consciousness? That's not quite what the physicists are saying, because nobody knows what consciousness is. So the act of observation is generally determined or described objectively as well.
But consciousness changes our being,
yeah? Well, we've been here before. We have been here before, and I've tried to explain before. I don't like to be a school teacher here.
Sorry.
I don't think you understand the depth of what's going on here. Consciousness, there are certain processes going on in the brain that have consciousness associated with them.
Okay.
Yes? And those processes change things, but that's different to saying that consciousness changes
things.
I just have a memory of somewhere in an earlier class.
I know.
Where we've done that before.
Yes.
Can I just ask, is quantophrenia your word that you're adding to the
dictionary? It was a word that I heard in a lecture in the 1970s to describe It was a lecture about the nature of bureaucracy. And the lecturer said, you know, that contophrenia is a strategy used by bureaucrats to prolong and to enhance their own existence. And I kind of grabbed the word because I liked it. But I kind of, you know, it wasn't I didn't invent it, but I like it because it describes the behaviour of so many institutions. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to quantify this.
Where are you on that? Heaven Kevin.
It's an object, so.
No. It's gone. So I'm just going to read the next slide, which, you know, where we stopped last time was with Helen Keller, and that moment where she had her hand under the water. Sorry, what's your name?
Michael.
So you're probably not aware of that. So I should.
Yes, I am. I was taught it before I came in.
Oh, you were taught before you came. You see, yeah. So we got a bit of Helen Keller's moment, where something occurred there that was quite unusual. You see, Boltoff doesn't really analyse this, but she got language later than you would ordinarily have done. So she already had a kind of a, you know, if we're looking at it in a neurological way, her brain was already quite developed without having language. So the moment of language occurring to her as she was six would have been quite different to language occurring as it does when you're younger. Well, I'm not sure, I'm not even, you have no kids, but that 18 months, 2 years, something like that?
Yes, 6 months.
Earlier than the 6 months?
Yeah.
Single words.
Yes,
not.
We're looking at this moment with Helen Keller, where she realizes that it's water, and she didn't know that it was water before, and that wasn't. She didn't know that there was this sound, this word sound, water, that you associate with water. She didn't know what water was. As in its own, as a being.
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, you could equally argue that what the word water gave up was a social connection to everybody else's concept of water. And so the power that came in the language at that point was realising one's social nature, not actually anything about essences.
So,
as an alternative.
So, but what we're aiming at here is not a theory. It's to see if we can, because Helen Keller is describing something that happened to her, and I guess the aim here is to see if we can re-enter what it was that she experienced, even though.
Well, of course, if I'm making a theory, I've already re-entered it, haven't I? I mean, in my own way, because otherwise I couldn't talk about it.
Re-entered what?
The experience that Helen Keller had. I've already reimagined Helen Keller in myself.
Yes, that...
What happens when I get a new word, okay?
But no,
Is it that I get an essence of the thing? Or is it the fact that because everybody around me has got that word, suddenly I connect with everybody, it's a wonderful feeling? But I'm just saying, you have to... If you're going to say it's about the essence of the thing that you're realising at that point, you have to dismiss the social argument.
But I'm not... I'm going to have to ask Michael, and I don't want to be...
That's okay.
Doing this course, a sort of a prerequisite for it is that you've got an understanding of phenomenology. And that I've imparted, in a way. Yes.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Because not that you've read phenomenology, but that we've been through a process in the course, and I feel like I'm going to have to to explain to you what's going on here. I'm going to have to redo that, and it's too late.
No, it's fine. I've been through phenomenology, and
I'd ask you if you wouldn't mind just listening, rather than because it was. I feel that we're going to have to go into a fundamental dialogue about the nature of philosophy, and the nature of reflection, and what phenomenological reduction is about. Because, yes, and I don't have time to do that. So, I've got to, you know, I can hear that you're coming from a very different place, and if I call it theoretical, then I'm going to enter into a debate with you, you know, and we don't have time to do that. So, will you just go along? Will you be willing just to go along?
Yes.
And that doesn't mean shut up entirely,
No.
just to give us a chance to get back into the place where we were at with this experience that Helen Keller had, which I'm only asking, really, that we, as far as possible, whether we can get a sense of water being it's to do with the word and whether it refers to something that you already have. And what the Helen Keller quote was trying to express is that she didn't have water.
Is language as discursive?
Yes, but we're trying to get to the because we're already in language. And the sense I think that we all have with language is that I certainly got it from my own, I don't know from where, maybe from our culture, that you could kind of take language away and I'd still see the table. That's what a lot of this Bortov chapter is going on with. And in a way, you could kind of debilitate my ability to speak now, and I would see the table. I just, you know, you can sort of see that if you just took away my ability to utter language, you can kind of settle down your reflective thinking consciousness and just have the world before you. But you still, in a way, see the table. And the chair, and the window, whether you utter it to yourself or not, and what we're trying to get at here is the nature of that background pre-understanding of the world that's already in operation.
I thought it was the opposite. I thought with the Helen Keller example that the world to her was just sort of like a cacophony of sense experience. It was like a copy of sense experience, and her being able to, without that grasping of the disclosure of water, where it disclosed this object of water to her and the sensation with it, then all of a sudden then she realised that it wasn't a world of sort of sensory experience, but that there was sort of there were things to be identified.
Made it specific.
Yeah, that's right.
But what I guess the moment I'm getting is that there wasn't any water for her until that connection was made.
Yeah.
She didn't. What the world was before that.
But she must have had a sense of it, because if she'd never experienced water, and somebody suddenly stuck her hand under this cold rushing stuff, she would have been frightened.
But do you see how hard it is if she'd never experienced water? We're in language. The difficulty here is everything that we're saying to try and understand this is occurring within language.
No,
and we're trying to grasp what in a just glimpsing way, almost out of the corner of the eye, that the sort of instant before there is language.
So if her hand had gone underwater before, it must have done, because she would have been bathed.
Yes.
So she was under this thing, and she didn't have a name for it, but she was just enjoying it, or not enjoying it, or, you know, but it was something that was going on. She didn't have a name for it. And she wouldn't have, was she not able to come up with a name, the way children do come up with names for things that they don't have a name for yet?
But she hadn't heard language.
So she hadn't heard language, so she didn't have anything. So do we know what was going on then when she was being bathed or having a drink of something, you know, or... What was happening there?
You mean, did she have
recognition? Have
I gone off track? So that, I don't know that it's nobody's going off track. We're circling round something here.
Mm.
And I mean, another way that I can use to describe it, which is also from the course that most people didn't do, was I mean, Heidegger tried to explain this by going in a long transposition of us looking into what it's like to be an animal, and what is animal consciousness. 'Cause for Heidegger, he wants to say that animals don't have a world. And his understanding of that is that... animal consciousness encounters an environment only insofar as that environment is related to itself and its own needs. So the picture that Heidegger paints, he calls it a ring of disinhibition. So the environment, because the animal's here with us, right, but in a different way. And he's trying to get to, well, how is it different? The environment impinges on the animal in such a way as it elicits behaviour. So the environment is experienced as something that elicits behaviour. And within that, the animal's not seeing... the being of whatever it is that's eliciting the behaviour. Now, I'm only approaching it from a different angle. And what we're saying here is that the seeing of the being of something in itself, it and language are the same thing. There's no seeing of the being as it is in itself, and then having language and then sticking them together. What the key message here is that the realization that of the being of something is also the having of language. So it's all about this sense of the being of beings. I mean, you know, I know those of you who've read your Heidegger, well, there's being with a capital B, which is being itself, and then there's the being of all the beings, the tables, the chairs, the people, the things around us, and the manners in which they disclose themselves. And there are levels of disclosing. And there's,
it's almost like she had a memory though, isn't it? I mean, she said, suddenly I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten.
Yes.
A thrill of returning thought.
Yes.
And somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me.
Yes. Yes. And we were reading that last week and reminding ourselves, I guess, that Helen Keller is making sense of this with language, of course. She wouldn't have been able to think that, or even have a conception of something returning, a misty consciousness returning. But she's this is like Marina. You were talking about that experiencing being a blind child,
mm.
and how wherever we are, we can't but help project back our where we are now in the way that we see the past.
Yeah.
And Helen's doing that. But at the same time, we're reading her with extreme sympathy to try and get a sense of grasp of what she was, what she experienced there, because she experienced some kind of complete illumination about the nature of language that we, in fact, are trying to approach again. Yes.
I have a distant memory of making a connection between the word, a word, and something becoming manifest. Because when you're very small and you can't get up and go to the fridge and get stuff out for yourself or whatever, you know, if you go, apple, you know, and you say it often enough, it gets brought to you, it becomes manifest.
Yes.
And so it's like, in a way, this idea of language disclosing the world, it is an infantile experience, isn't it? You say something often enough and it is manifested.
Yes.
But you have to be able to make the connection between the word and what you want, the thing that you want, for that to happen. And I have a sense of not knowing what something was, not having the word for it, and going, and it's not manifested because I don't know what it is. I know what I want. I want this thing that tastes like this and looks like that.
Yes, we're onto something here.
I can't.
Yes, we're onto something. No, you are. I'm hearing in that what you're describing. There's the you're after a certain experience.
Mm. Yes.
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 Which is when we were talking about the ring of disinhibition of the animal. The animal's after a certain experience, and being after a certain experience isn't the same as knowing what an apple is.
Mm. Yes,
but
have language for it.
Yes, but when you have language, it manifests the apple, but it doesn't manifest something in a way that you before language you don't know what it is, you don't know what an apple is, but you know you we're, what we're looking at here, it, like Helen knew the experience of water on the hand, but she didn't know that it was water.
Mm.
And you are articulating something there of knowing that there's an experience that you're wanting, but it's utterly referring to you.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the being of an apple.
No.
In it.
No.
Are we getting a bit closer to the
but
sense
when it
of
gets, when it comes, you know, when I've learned the word for it and it comes, I know that that's what it is.
Yes, and that part of what this entire lecture is in a way the that moment of the disclosure of language is soon forgotten, because the word apple then is you know, it brings the thing to you, but you already know the thing that you want to bring to you, so it becomes a means of of getting what you want.
Mm.
But it's actually also related to what Michael is saying. I mean, if you look at language in terms of if it's only me in the universe, and I don't need to communicate, I don't need to point to this thing for somebody to bring it to me, I don't need to cry for my mom to feed me, you know, then there won't be language. I would be probably under no reason to develop any methodology of creating this system for my own understanding. You know, I will remain this animal in this ring.
Yes.
So the need to even, you know, have a concept of anything, water or whatever, is in a way just in its relation to the need of communicating with another being, whatever that other being is. So it's kind of like my question, I suppose, is you know, this when we say, yeah, you know, the language is what brings things into being and meaning. Is it kind of just as a standalone and would be required for for intelligent life by itself, or is it just as a bridge to communicate?
Well, I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look back at our kind of look into the origins of language, it seems that it will have emerged out of our... I mean, I'm following Maturana here.
Mm.
It was just a more and more sophisticated way for us to coordinate our being together.
Yeah.
But the emergence of language that we're talking about here doesn't happen immediately. You know, I feel like there must have been something like a moment of realization, like Helen had, for some possibly adult human being who was already immersed in a sort of the beginnings of language. Do you know, because you see this coordination that you see between dolphins and whales and many different animals. And of course we don't know what a dolphin's experiencing. Mm. Language itself is going to pop out of that, isn't it? Out of behaviour that is all about coordinating.
Yeah. So it's a sophistication, it's kind of, you know...
Well, no, I think when language pops out like we're looking at here, something's happened that goes beyond the theory of evolution, if you like. Yeah, something has popped out that's a capacity that... I don't want to say any more than that. That it's not something that is explicable in terms of DNA, if you like. Whereas the emergence of coordinated behaviours between animals is something that you could give a kind of a physicalistic explanation. Something happens in the emergence of language that is if you like, advent of pure meaning.
Yeah, I mean, because all of this conversation is actually brought me back to, you know, if you read in Genesis.
I was reading Genesis.
Yeah.
This week.
And the world comes to negative. God said.
Yeah.
You know, it's all said.
God spoke it out.
God
spoke
said.
It into being.
And it's like, you know,
in the beginning was the Word.
Yeah.
And the word was...
Who did he say it to? You know, he said, didn't he? He kind of said, let there be light.
Yes.
You know, but who did he say it to? I don't know. He just said to, you know, if he
said
was...
it to God.
If he was a consciousness, well, who did he call, you know? So it's kind of that does relate, isn't it? Because that's kind of a very, kind of, how do you call it, aesthetic or beautiful way of expressing this kind of idea that it's kind of... Everything comes into meaning by saying it or by languaging it or whatever.
Yes.
And then in the second chapter, you know, man is kind of given the task of naming the animals.
Yeah, yeah. I was just reading that. It's very synchronistic.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
It's like, well,
we were allowed to do the saying of the animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, and it's just a, it's a fable, isn't it? It's a fable. I mean. We named the animals, we named the furniture, we named everything after that. So it's kind of like, so again, this is what I'm kind of saying. It's the question is, where is the need to name stuff exist even just for your own sake, or?
No, I mean, as far as we see it, right? It is entirely handed on through our culture.
Mm.
But we all communicate, I mean, it's obvious we all communicate socially.
Yes. Yeah, and that's what we were saying to begin with, that it wasn't about naming stuff. To begin with, it was about our being together, our expressing our feelings, really, for each other.
Mm.
So I'm going to read the next slide because nobody else can. Yes, although I did have a lovely picture of some water there going over a hand. that's, which was supposed to going to help this a lot, you know, the water going over the hand. So Helen Keller is oh no, come back. Just lost the Helen Keller is blind but describes herself as seeing with a new light. The word water does not represent or stand for water here. It is not a label to be attached to water for the purpose of communicating information. She does not already know water, to which she then adds the word. In this case, everything is reversed. The word water shows her water. It brings it to light so that she sees it. Here the name calls water into appearance. It calls water into being as water, instead of the indistinct sense awareness which was there before, which we've been, I think, in our way, trying to talk about. The word here is not a sign that designates something already known, because the thing designated by it would first have had to have been seen independently of language, and evidently it had not been. The word water allows water to manifest, and only in this sense can the word be said to indicate water. I mean, I'm not. One of the reasons I don't read the slides out is because I don't actually hear the meaning of the slide when I'm reading it.
It does help us, though.
Does help you?
Well, it helps me.
Yes.
I'm like, 'cause I read the thing. And,
yes. Because yeah. I feel like I've been trying to cover this, because at the center of this, the whole chapter. In a way, is just repeating the same thing over and over. Words don't designate; they bring into being. That you could say, and we're saying it in many different ways. They bring whatever they say into being. But that's something that we fall. We don't live in that moment of manifestation in our ordinary daily consciousness. That's what he wants to say. So the next slide, I'm just going to read it, see if we've got anything new here. Saying as showing. Heidegger says that the essential being of language is saying as showing, capital S, capital S. Although in German, unfortunately I don't have the German, and that saying is in no way the linguistic expression added to the phenomena after they have appeared. So you see, this is a repetition, in a way, of what Bortoff was saying. A sign is to be understood fundamentally as showing in the sense of bringing something to light. If we do not understand the sign in this way, but think of it instead as something that designates, then the kinship of showing and what it shows is lost and becomes transformed into a conventional relation between a sign and its signification. So these are all quotes from Heidegger, just in a way putting it in Heidegger's language, what Bortoff was saying. And the Helen Keller example is Bortoff's attempt to bring what Heidegger's saying to some kind of concrete event. When Heidegger says that the essence of language is saying as showing, he does not mean saying to be taken in the sense of a being that says, but more in the sense of a saying which bees. So, yes, and in the German, you know, this is an attempt to... A saying that bees, yes, a saying that brings what is said to being. To a manifesting of itself as itself from itself, which is another Heideggerian phrase. Similarly with showing, this is not showing a being, like shining a light on an object in the dark, but the showing in which its appearance, and it's got this emphasis that you can't see, when he wants appearance to be read as a verb, that an appearance is a something that's happening every moment. It's the showing, which is its appearance wherein it bees. Bees, not buzzing bees, you know, BE apostrophe S. So Heidegger's one of his famous phrases is that language is the house of being.
What about all the different levels that a word can have? So, like, if you've never eaten a banana, you've only seen a picture of a banana. Like, I'm not conscious, not five, I suppose. So that your understanding of the banana would only be as far as your experience. It would be a picture in a book or in a film.
Well, no, we've got to go with the unsaid here. If you're shown a banana, you know what a fruit is.
Yeah.
Do you know there's an enormous... You know, language just stretches out. You can't ever really be shown a banana out of context.
Oh, yeah.
You've got...
Yeah. I mean, your meaning of it, if you haven't tasted it...
Yes.
It's not the same as the meaning of someone who's tasted it. I suppose it's like going back to interpretations of Hamlet, but...
But do you see this?
But the beingness of it is sort of only limited to... So it's unique to you.
No, yeah, I think it's like Hamlet, you're right. The banana's a bit like Hamlet, right? It's going to manifest slightly differently to everyone, but there's still, you know... This...
And to different, you know, completion. It's not a complete knowing of it.
No, but that, this is like someone who doesn't quite understand Elizabethan English, isn't it? They're not...
Yeah, I
guess. Yeah. Yeah, so... Yes? So it's not that every being manifests the same to everyone, but that doesn't mean that there's no being.
But where is the being?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? the asking the question, where is the being... I'm not sure that doesn't take us beyond the domain of phenomenology. You know, it's like, well, the being is in its appearing, would be the phenomenological answer. And you're looking for a being behind the appearance is a kind of a metaphysical attempt to work things out. You know, where is the being? I hand you the banana. You see, there's a kind of a nonsense in it, isn't it? I hand you the banana and you say, well, where's the being of the banana? And what could you possibly answer except by giving you a banana?
But the name is the thing. The thing comes into being by the name. But the name, it's different for different.
Well, then
how
do
you get to know that banana?
Well, I guess when we're looking at the name is. We're looking at language itself, and it's we're attempting to see language in itself and what it does. And the name is part of or what's said.
The connection, yes. So you can't know the water without feeling.
Yes, or in some way,
and the feeling together.
But in some way or other, you see what language does is it discloses an awful lot of stuff to us that we've never seen or touched, like Uzbekistan.
Mm.
Yes, as an example.
I know from...
But some of us might know as because...
Thinking about my own experiences, I know that when I learn a new word, a word for something, suddenly I see that thing everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, before I learn the word, for whatever thing it is that I suddenly begin to see, I don't notice, or it doesn't manifest itself to me, that thing does not manifest itself to me. And then somebody... points it out, and suddenly it's like, it's everywhere. Why hadn't I noticed that before? It's very strange how, you know, I mean, when I've never had a car in my life, and my family's never had a car. We've been carless and completely, they're mysterious to us. And I never really saw cars as being differentiated from each other other than by colour. I couldn't recognise.
No, I've met people like that as well.
And I didn't have a relationship with anyone who had a car either for years and years and years. The cars were just not part of my life, apart from those noisy things you had to be careful of. And then, of course, I met somebody who had a car that they were very proud of, and I learned that that car was a particular type of car.
Yes.
And suddenly, out of this miasma of noise and horribleness that I just learned to avoid, I suddenly began, there's one of those, one of those. I began to see them everywhere. You know, and you know, they manifested themselves
yes.
to me out of this mass of traffic.
Yes.
Like.
Yes. Again, you're giving a great example that we're backtracking in a way here. That's a manifestation and a distinction that's happening within your already having language.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in a way we're trying to back project that to envisage never having language and first getting it.
Yes.
Yes.
Difficult.
Yeah, it's difficult. But do you what the phenomenon you were just describing with the car? It gives a hint of that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
You get a sense of.
Yes, because and it's and you're like my friend Clive, you know. I was just because I do distinguish cars, and it's you know he's just got a girlfriend with a car, and I said, well, you know, as you do, well, what kind of car? And he said, well, it's red.
Yeah.
It's
especially modern cars.
That's all you say, isn't it?
I was horrified. I was just horrified.
Because he's red. Yeah. Yeah.
It could be anything, you know.
See, in contrast to that, Maria, my grandfather, who brought me up for some of my life, my early life, he loved cars. So, you know, Triumph and a Mini and a Austin... Healy or something, not an Austin.
They were nice in those.
You know, anyway, a Morris or something, Morris Minor.
Morris Minor.
And then, you know, that's, anyway, he was really into cars and colours. And it's just interesting because then I really like cars, you know, because I was sort of, that was in me. And I used to get little presents of cars, the Matchbox toys, and used to play with them. And so I have a different thing where I can really appreciate what. Like cars, you know. It's just, yeah, it's, I don't know why I'm saying that, but it's just
yes.
interesting contrast.
But no, it's a good example,
yeah.
isn't it, about how.
And John loves cars. Right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Well, same thing as my dad, you know.
So fortunately, I do like that.
Maybe the words that he wanted to use to bring things into being, actually for him, were more attractive about his girlfriend than a car.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, it was. No, Clive doesn't care about cars.
Yeah.
He's got a whole. He's, but he.
He
but
it would be musical.
But it seems to be, you know, it seems to be what you, a lot to do with your childhood and how you and you know
you
just what
music.
We're saying whether you're given that power to distinguish early, but also there's something about what where you're drawn, as well. It's a mixture, isn't it? So something I don't know why it just doesn't suit me reading slides, but I'm going to do it because I've got to do it. Right? I can't flick them up. This way we actually get through the class, which is an unusual thing, isn't it?
And
some of you've got.
We
maybe,
could bring it up on if you had a point today. Could
yeah, but you could bring it up on your phone, but that would be worse, wouldn't it? Everybody going, oh yeah, sorry. So. Designation and disclosure. Primarily, the word indicates in the sense of shows. It does not designate in the sense of points to. So there's quite a lot of repetition going on here, right? He's hammering away about this Heideggerian distinction between designating and disclosing. And Maria, you were saying about aletheia, weren't you?
Mm.
Aletheia, or... Yes, Margarita isn't here. She actually... knew how to pronounce the word. I have my own way, and I think that's the way it ought to be. Aletheia, I think that's how it should. But if you ask a Greek person, it's the word for truth, but it meant its root came from unconcealedness. So, for Heidegger, this goes very deep. Right, the whole idea of something being true is that it's unconcealed, and for something to be untrue, it's because it's concealed in some way. It's pseudo. This all comes back into his idea of language being a disclosive event. So what usually happens is that we only recognize the secondary representational word. which designates and not the primary disclosive word. The disclosive word which shows makes it possible for the word to designate. We could say that the disclosive word is the background within the word. That should be within which the word is able to be used to designate. I think I copy this from the book, so it's a typo in the book. We don't notice this disclosive background because it is upstream from the secondary function of language upon which our attention is usually focused. So Heidegger's has a lot to say about the word as, that we always see something as. This is part of hermeneutics as well. That whenever we use language explicitly to say something, we're always in this designating way. We're always designating something that's already been disclosed to us. That's all he's trying to point out here, that there's a background of disclosure within which we already are, upon which, when we use language in a designating way, we're designating something that's already disclosed to us. And Heidegger, in Being in Time, although he kind of doesn't take this, it sort of drops out of what he says in his later philosophy, he looks into this background as the being of the ready to hand, where initially everything is disclosing itself to us more in the way that we were talking about for the animal. It's disclosing itself in terms of what it's for, not what it is. Yeah, it's so that the chair's disclosing itself as something to be sat upon, the door's disclosing itself as something to be,
hello,
something to be opened. You know, the room is something to be traversed across. You know, the entire world is open to us to begin with through our embodiment, you know, through our capacities to act. And it's on the background of all of those invitations and capacities to act that we can bring something to some kind of distinct consciousness, which he never used the word consciousness, being present at hand. And Heidegger goes into a long... He talks a lot about hammers, you know, and you don't really see the hammer as a hammer when you're working. It's a sort of an extension of your arm that's four banging nails in, and you don't really see the nail. You're engaged in the work. You know, what you're really seeing is the work that you're doing. That's the kind of place that you're in, that you're involved in. And it's only if there's something goes wrong, if you hit the nail and it bends, then in a way the nail kind of emerges as something that's problematic. And it's this emerging of things as problematic where Heidegger's story, if you like, of language starts to emerge out of that. That's where things start to present themselves as individual entities that kind of emerge as if they've got their independent being. You know, when you're actually just engaged in action, everything's connected to everything else. There's a sort of a network of one thing connected to another, connected to another, connected to another, and your interaction is all about what it is you're trying to do, not about looking at the things themselves. But the things themselves emerge when they obstruct you, when they get in the way of what you want to do. And he's got a long story about how our own ability to think and reflect and do science, if you like, is a kind of a, is built up on all of that background of having to deal with things that have got in our way. As we kind of perfect that, we start to be able to think entirely abstractly about things and take them out of the context of the world, as he calls it. He calls that de-worlding. So we actually, you know, most of our reflection on things is actually having extracted it out of this background of significance within which we spend a lot of our lives, but we don't make it explicit. You see, the thing about, we have a sort of an experience of, I mean, I certainly do. I have an experience where it almost seems to me that I'm thinking all the time and I'm making things explicit all the time. But it's more to do with your making things explicit is what you remember. You don't remember all the intervening parts where you weren't thinking and making anything explicit. You were just doing what you were doing. It doesn't leave the same trace. But it doesn't mean it didn't happen. So that, because there's often this sense that that this background is some kind of inaccessible place that you know that you can't get in touch with, and it's strangely it is, because if you try and make the background explicit, it's the foreground. Do you see? As soon as you think about it, reflect on it, you see the background is, it's not the background anymore. You can't look at the background. Because it's not the background anymore. An awful lot of reading Heidegger, in a way, is that's why it gets almost poetic, is because you have to be sort of almost seduced into recognizing the background. But it's not that it's not with you all the time. It's not that it's not utterly familiar to you, in a way. It's just unfamiliar to the objectifying, reflecting consciousness. Because and we're back again at something that sounds a little bit like the left and right brain distinction we were making. You know, it's like the right brain. Do you mind not doing that?
Yes, I tried it down. I tried it down the volume because I tried it right in the philosophy. Yes, it's because I tried it writing the spelling the Heidegger.
So we're talking about the disclosive word is disclosing in the background. The world's disclosed to us, but the designating word is what we're using in the foreground and what we're aware of. Yes, we still got. I'm just flying through the slides here. You haven't been to one of my lectures before. Usually, I'm still on slide 3. You know, because I'm reading. Yeah, this is last week's lectures. Manifesting being. It's we're attempting to speak Heidegger here, so that we put a hyphen in between being to indicate that things don't just be. The being is a kind of a verb. There's a continuous being occurring. So manifesting means, and I think we must be quoting Heidegger again. Heidegger here, the coming into appearance of the intelligibility (brackets logos) of what is, which means that the intelligible is not simply copied in language, but that in language the intelligible forms itself. So we're starting to look into, we've got a new word here, intelligibility. It's 137, 138. Intelligibility comes from intelligence, and it's the ability of intelligence, I guess. But if something's intelligible, it's understandable. So, but what does it mean to be understandable? And we've got a mixture now of the understanding and meaning and language are being wrapped into a single event, if you like. The again, the word intelligibility is coming at it from another side, that's saying something like, language is what makes the world intelligible. But you would say, well, is it unintelligible to a dog? So obviously intelligibility in the terms of logos here, it's intelligible in relation to being a world rather than a collection of possible things that I can do and desires that I can fulfill. Do you see there's this place where things come to stand? I don't like to use the word stand because it's mixed up with objectification. Things come to be in their own right, not in relation to its effect on you. That's one way to put it. Not that layer of the being of anything, of course, emerges out of that background of all of its, of that understanding that's an embodied understanding. They're not separated. It's emerging out of that.
Do you think that Heidegger was really fully aware of what animals were capable of and knew a lot about it? Because I'm very unconvinced a lot of the time by what he says in that story. I mean, you've said that for him the world is not unintelligible to a dog, but the dog can't, I suppose, the dog cannot bring the world to mind.
So it's all, but
dogs know when somebody that they care about isn't there and they wait for them, so they obviously have a concept of that person when the person's not around.
Yes.
They have a concept of their food when their food's not around. They have a concept of the park when they're not in the park because they want to go there.
Yes. It's clear that if a concept is thought of in terms of the capacity to distinguish different classes of things, then dogs show that capacity to distinguish in their behaviour. But what we're speaking of here is whether being is manifest to a dog. Which is different to being able to distinguish between you and someone else and having desires for your presence, for an interaction with you, or a desire for food, or a desire to chase a ball. It's not about being able to distinguish, and it's not about having concepts in that sense. It's a matter of whether being is manifest to a dog. And I guess my... if you read Heidegger, you can read Heidegger in one way, and you can say, "Oh, what is he proposing here?" He's proposing a model of how animals perceive and what animal consciousness is like. He's presenting a theory, if you like, of animal consciousness. Whereas I guess I don't read Heidegger that way. Heidegger has some essential insight that he's already has into language, and he's trying to illustrate it. So do you see that's different to having a theory of
animal behaviour?
Because of course he doesn't know the neuroscience. He can't really know what a dog's experiencing. He's projecting back his insight into what language is, into what being must be like without language. And I guess our ability to transpose ourselves into animal consciousness If we're going to say there's any ground to it, it would be you'd have to start wandering off into Jungian psychology and say there's a collective unconscious there and all of the animal experience is in some sense is in there and that we do have access to it, but that's not something that we could throw.
Maybe the example of
I guess
my... We have an example of children who were brought up by dogs and children who were brought up by wolves from a very early age and didn't develop language and were able to communicate a little bit later in life.
But what we... I'm bringing it back to phenomenology.
Yeah.
What we have is our actual interactions with dogs, which... I mean, where that comes down to me, for me, is if you look into a dog's eyes, if I look into a dog's eyes, that I know, and we'll put this in quotes because it says it's a phenomenological knowing. I know that the dog doesn't see me in the way that I see the dog, and I can recognize in when I look into a human being looking back at me, that a human being is sometimes, not always, aware of me in a way that a dog is not. So again, phenomenologically, there's some kind of knowledge of being seen when a human being sees you. Now, that's another way into this, right? And if you look into the way, when a dog looks at you, try it. Although dogs can get, they don't like it, do they? Being really looked into, and it's quite easy to get a surge of fear. I don't know. Do you get afraid of dogs sometimes? If you look straight into their eyes, I don't get afraid.
Talk to them and do a little dance.
No. Doing that kind of stuff. That's okay. I mean, actually, this. You're looking. You're inquiring of the dog's being. Yes.
True.
Yeah. The dogs don't like. I find they don't really like to be inquired into in that way. And it
don't like being inquired.
No, but with. You don't need to really stare. I've told you about the deer, haven't I? It came crystal clear to me when I was sitting out in the forest, you know, romantically in Northern California, you know, on the cabin steps with the apples, feeding the deer, and I realized in a click really, the deer, I just don't care. I drop my pants. Let's not go into all the things I could do in front of the deer. I'm just not self-conscious, viscerally,
yeah,
in front of a deer. If the deer comes out and I'm having a crap, maybe you would be concerned about what the deer thought, but you're not, are you? You see, the deer just doesn't see you. Like, as soon as another person comes along, this is, I put it to you phenomenologically, you entirely change.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have
So we're saying we don't. It's a kind of a theory we have about what animal consciousness is like. Well, no, it's more than that. You see, we have a sense of that the animal doesn't see us, and that a human being does. But somewhere in that difference in sense, there's we have language the animal doesn't.
But I worked as an au pair in Italy, and the woman I worked for was very prudish in the sense that if anybody called, she would, you know, she wouldn't answer the door before she got fully dressed and all the rest of it. But her and her husband, in front of me, would walk around naked, go to the toilet, everything, because I didn't matter.
You were a dog.
I was like a dog. It was really interesting that, you know, they were very careful about their behaviour in front of their friends or their associates.
But
in front of me, you know, it was like...
So are you saying it's more to do with classism than it's to do with the nature of language?
I think that sense of that I was a being that didn't matter, you know, it really hit me. I was like a pet dog.
Yes, but we're not talking about that we grant being to just to human beings. When we're talking about language, we're talking about granting a whole sense of being is in language. What you were experiencing there is, you know, the sad history of the human race, where we fail to recognise the human being, which we're saying is a languaging being, but that's at a certain level, that distinction is saying, I'm not counting you as part of that community. But it's still not strictly true. You could burst through. I'm sure you did in certain moments.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, you made sure they knew that you were. Yeah, didn't you? It was. They had no choice. Yes. That's when you took all your clothes off, I suppose. Yes. Yes. So I'm one of you. You know. It's.
So here's
another quote. I forget who made this quote. This wasn't Heidegger. When the carrot shoots emerge from the earth, they display themselves for the rabbit as well as for the gardener. The difference is that the gardener understands that the carrots are carrots. He can be aware of their manifestness as such. Their manifestness as such. Does this any meaning to you? In a way, the rabbit cannot. And again, I ask you, although they hop off, but if you've got a pet rabbit, I think again, we can have an enforced observation.
I've got two.
You've got two. When we say that, it just reminds me of the Queensland border. What is it? $50,000 if they find a rabbit on you.
What?
Because rabbits in Australia just ravage the land. Every time I go across the border to see it, it seems very sad. So sad, you know. Virtually, you're executed if you're found with a rabbit. It's like, it's your...
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, they picked on the rabbits, the cats and the dogs. Yeah. But the cats especially have decimated the... No, we're not worried about the indigenous species. We're worried about the cash value of our crops, my dear, of course. That's what matters, isn't it? That's where you get a $50,000 fine. Plus, if you did that for cats now, I mean, I don't know. Well, being in England, you know, there's only one thing that you can't show on television, isn't there? That's a dog being killed. Anyway.
the term as such, what does that mean?
As such, well, because the rabbit sees the carrot, but not as a carrot.
Right.
So as such means as it is in itself, from itself, if you like.
Right.
In its very being. Or, you know, I don't know. I feel like essence is a word maybe that has a trigger here. I don't know. But in its essence, if you like, if there's a essence.
It was from Michael Zimmerman. That
yes. Yeah, I thought it was somebody... I hadn't heard of.
I thought the only difference between a human and a rabbit in respect to a carrot was that the rabbit eats it immediately and the human knows how to wait to get a bit more.
Yes. Yeah. Whereas we're saying that no, there's more than that.
Yeah, right.
Yes, there's more than that in the way...
And I guess that shows that thing again was an animal not perhaps being able to imagine another place than the place where they are aware as we can.
Well, funnily enough, I've been writing about that this week,
yeah.
And I think that an animal is quite capable of envisaging the satisfaction of a desire, which in a way is an envisaging of the world being different to how it is. It lacks, and this is where we're going to conjecture in a way. We can't go too far. in a way, neuroscience could probably answer this, but we have the capacity to play around with our envisaging. We kind of that the thing that an animal envisages is sort of determined by their immediate desiring, whereas we have the capacity in a way to set, and that's what you were saying. I think we can, you know, we can cut the cord, and we can think about stuff and envisage stuff that we're not immediately desiring, although there's an argument there that, well, in fact, you are desiring to distract yourself. You know, you've got a kind of a... It's quite hard to say that we ever are free of desire.
Well, what about this, though?
But we've got a much greater freedom in our capacity to envisage stuff.
And I guess to bank things, to say, OK, well, I am looking forward to this, and I know it's going to come, and I can just sit here and wait that out.
Yes, yes.
Whereas
I've been on this too. It's the realization that in your world of envisagement, there comes a point where you actually bump into yourself. You think, oh my God, somewhere, I feel like this is part of maybe the birth of language, is in that world of envisaging, you come to envisage yourself as an entity in that world.
That's almost the sort of the intention setting or visualization where, you know, I do that a lot, I do that with clients, where I invite them to visualize themselves in a better situation because subconsciously they're going to work towards this vision.
Yes.
And so that's very strong. I know that my rabbits in the morning, they know that they're going to be let out.
Yes.
And they want to be let out. So they don't know they're going to be let out, so that they can just, you know, sit and wait until that moment comes. They're like, I need to be on the other side, and they start gnawing all crazy. And
yes.
So they don't have that, oh, this happens every day, we will be let out. They're like, let us out now.
Yes.
So that's the urge.
Yes. Yeah.
If envisaging is the actual action which makes a word designating, okay, because when you envisage, you do a relativity job in abstraction.
Just pause on that. I don't think we don't need to envisage to make a word designate, do we? They're together. Well,
I think if you don't envisage, you're actually an animal, perhaps. And then you're living somewhere else other than designation. So the only place we know that's other than designation
is
disclosure.
But
so animals must be living in disclosure. And we haven't caught up with them because we've got this envisaging, which keeps us in designation.
But you're designating all the time right now, aren't you, without envisaging? Aren't we just designating as we speak?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, if you don't designate, if you don't time travel, if you don't look at things in a context, you don't get designation. Designation is essential to actually make an object so you can relate it to other things, presumably so you can do something about it, okay? Disclosure is something quite different. Now, if animals don't have designation, which you're claiming they don't, then they must live.
Did I claim that? I don't think I was.
Less,
I didn't think I was claiming. I don't remember claiming that.
Yeah,
well, no,
yeah.
I'm not sure.
I don't know what designation.
I'm not sure that we've said that.
Designation is
the fact that we're feeling. Yeah. No, designation is. It's to do with the word being a sign. So what a word is something quite distinct from what it designates. So you've got the word, and you've got the thing, and the word, if it's like, is like a pointer from the word to the thing.
Oh, like designated smoking area.
It's in philosophy, it's called reference. The reference of a word. What it refers to. So you've got a sign and what it signifies as two different things, and the job of the sign is to signify something that isn't the sign, which is different to the idea that the word manifests the thing itself.
So that's disclosure?
That's disclosure, yes. Disclosure. Yes. Whereas the designation is a kind of a tool. Yeah, it's something that you use. And it's not saying that we don't use language to designate, But I hadn't actually thought about whether animals designate and use signs. I think we could say that they do.
John, I think our animals definitely do.
Yeah. So I can back out of my own. If I claim that, I don't claim that now. I think animals can use signs and designate.
Sure,
yeah. Yes. It's the disclosure that they're not. Yes.
I mean, when I did studies at university, I did something called animal sociology, and animals relate to each other. And the prof that I was working with, he had done experiments with dolphins, and he said that he'd spent 2 weeks teaching a dolphin how to get a fish by remembering a very complicated sequence of things, which involved identifying things of a different colour, a different shape, understanding the difference between left and right, and they had to learn a sequence. And then when they came in the pool, they had to find the third green triangle on the left and the fourth blue square on the right. And it was always changed every time. And the red circle on the bottom. And then they had to go and tap these things in a particular sequence. And it took him 2 weeks to teach this dolphin this very complicated sequence. And then he put the dolphin back with the others. And when he took the next dolphin out to teach it, it already knew.
Yeah.
It went straight to those things. And he said the first one must have told it. How else would the second dolphin know that sequence that it had taken 2 weeks?
And he
was amazed.
Yeah.
He couldn't believe it.
No,
he did it again and again with different dolphins. And they do. They can communicate concepts like square, triangle, green, blue, left, right, third, fourth. And that to me is a very high order of language, and they have it.
So let's back out of that. So there are two things. I was thinking of Sheldrake too, but I don't think Sheldrake works here. So I don't know if you're all familiar. I don't know if you're familiar with morphic resonance, but morphic resonance doesn't happen as quick as that. So just once it's quite weak. So there is an indication there that the dolphins probably were able to indicate to each other how to do something, yes? But I trust that you see that that's not the same as the disclosure of being. In order to transmit that information, you didn't need to have to disclose the being of anything. It just shows that they've got a. It's something that, as a computer scientist, you could say, yeah, it's easily done.
Computer can learn a sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
And the computer next door will pick it up without ever being connected with the first computer.
No, the two dolphins. What we're implying is because they've got quite sophisticated.
Communication.
That within that dolphin language, it was possible to express what to do, which I think that is an open question because you'd have to decode what the sounds were designating, but that would be I think because we're talking about designation, that would be an example of the sounds being signs that led the second dolphin to do what it did. But it's all explicable on the level of designation. It doesn't say one way or the other whether the dolphins have a sense of the being of the of each other, for instance. Which I'm not. For me, dolphins are an open question. I did see a whale look at me once, and I thought it might be looking at me. But it was under the water again. And one does, it's easy to project this sort of stuff as well, because it's so massive and it had such a big eye.
Some animals do make you feel very, or they make you feel different in their presence. So like even the cat and the dog, I think you feel quite, well, I know I feel very different in the presence of a cat. I just feel there's a little bit more going. Sorry, to any dog lovers. But with a dolphin, there's something about a dolphin that I think makes me feel
makes me almost feel makes me feel quite spiritual, and I wonder what that is about the animal. You know, does the animal bring something? Is it that, you know, they're, what is it? You know, I guess certain animals have a, I don't know, maybe a spirit that makes us feel different in their presence.
Yeah, I mean,
people that swim with them, that, you know, we have friends that do a whole thing over in Florida or something like that, don't they?
Yeah,
you know,
swim with the dolphins. In fact, we could sign you up, 10%.
Please.
We get a
10%.
I want to
do this country. Please sign me up. Yes.
No, Atosh died, unfortunately,
yeah,
so she's.
Yeah.
I'm not sure of this. I guess somebody's still running it.
Somebody is still running it.
Didn't die of being attacked by dolphins.
No. But I know that there was a whole thing going on there about that. People that go through it, quite common around the world. You go through the
dolphin
horses, go on the boat.
And people say that about the whale, that when you look into the eyes of a whale, you know, like there's something about the universe.
We'll have to back out. You see, in that we don't have. It's not easy to bring the whale back now. But there's a lot of things operating there, isn't there? We have to be careful here, because I think for me the whale is a kind of a symbolic. There's something symbolic about a whale, you know, and so you are in a sense projecting something into the whale that then the whale just can't help but.
But are you?
Well, I think
that universally there are certain animals where that is the case, and you don't have quite the same when you look into a hamster's eye.
Now, the answer to that is I don't know. Is there something in the whale that's evoked our feeling for the whale?
Mm-hmm.
Quite possibly. I don't know.
There is a sense of that, isn't there? When they swear. I mean,
but you know, not so long ago, because we're reading Moby Dick at the moment, strangely enough.
Mm-hmm.
Not so long ago, it was a terrible monster, and we were heroes. You know, we were heroically harpooning them, these horrible monsters. Do you know? So it wasn't so long ago that it was considered an act of daring bravery to slaughter them. You know, so I think the Japanese still feel quite differently about the whale to the way that we do, and they think that we're just in a kind of la-di-da dream. You know, so the human race isn't at one over this.
It's more at one than it was.
It's more at one than it was, yes. I think the Japanese are, they've been isolated, and, you know, if it was, we've virtually excommunicated them.
Let's put it that way. I'm sure there's different animals where you will feel different. You know, you have your deer. That
yes.
You
yeah. Yeah.
Feel okay to expose yourself in front of all. Whatever.
I did not. I did not
but
actually do that.
But there might be animals where you may feel different about that. You know, maybe I know that.
A brown bear, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So I don't know if there is maybe something to do with a different awareness in the animal that make us also feel different in their presence.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, if a dog just is like, you know, there doesn't seem to be any sort of judgment, and a person who doesn't feel like a dog judges them maybe feel that the cat does, or that the cat does have a feeling or a response to what you're doing, where the dog is like, oh, is he? And the cat is like, oh, what are you doing?
The cat tests you, I think so.
The animal is, el animal is, if you test, coming.
So,
for me, the cat's,
yes, yes.
Yeah.
So, yes, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yes. So I feel like these are questions that are, in a way, it's a phenomenological thing. In that you're definitely seeing that in the cat,
mm-hmm.
and whether it's in the cat, I'm not sure how we could finally decide that. But we definitely know that, in a way, I suspect there is a, you know, back here you're projecting something into the cat, you're having a sense of the cat responding to it. Whether in it somewhere they join up, you know, and there is a unity there, it's difficult to say, because the human race has an awful history of projecting utterly untrue things.
Yeah, onto other humans.
You know, that, and if you were to place a bet, if you find a human being projecting something, you know, if you were Ladbrokes, you'd more or less certainly say that it's false. But that doesn't mean that it's always false. Do you know, there's a I think you have to go into a certain space of openness.
Can I ask a question, John?
To this is what Heidegger's about, to really allow something to manifest itself from itself. And it's yes.
I just wondered, okay, so the rabbit doesn't see the carrot as a carrot, the being of the carrot. The gardener sees it as a carrot.
Yes.
What about a person who's never seen a carrot before?
So a person who's never seen a carrot before is already in language and sees some sort of plant.
Right. So do they see the being of it?
They see it as something intelligible. It's already in language.
It's a type of plant.
But you don't think it's a type of plant. You see it as it is, but you don't have the exact word for it, you know. But that doesn't mean that it's fallen out of language. It's still held in language. It's insofar as it's intelligibly there for you, it's still held in language, and you can say that, you can, if you make it explicit, you say, yeah, it's a plant.
Orange root.
Well,
because you say, oh, it's a type of plant, to which I'd say, well, it's a type of carrot. You see, because somebody else would say, no, it's an orange bloomer or whatever.
Yeah, somebody.
And somebody else would say, yeah, no, I know the hybrid. Yeah. Do you know? Wherever we are, we generally have some kind of word, even if it's even if we know that we're lacking the precise word.
But that's the thing, is the level of blindness. So the person who doesn't know that it's a carrot is blind to the fact that it's a carrot. The person who knows it's a carrot but doesn't know what breed of carrot it is blind to the breed.
Yes.
And the person who knows the breed but doesn't know if it's a healthy specimen,
yes,
or unhealthy.
But see, what we're talking about is the power to distinguish.
It's the level of...
the power to distinguish gets finer and finer.
Yeah.
And our power to distinguish is always manifest in language.
So distinction is coming under... what we spoke yesterday, just now.
It seems like yesterday already.
Identification or disclosure. So this being able to distinguish.
Yes. It's part of our disclosure becoming more distinguished. More, you know, our disclosure becomes finer and finer. But what we're trying to talk about the disclosure itself. Because as long as we're already within disclosure, it just doesn't seem remarkable. Yes.
Is there something important here that you're not actually blind to seeing the carrot? Because there's nothing innate about that thing that makes it a carrot. You know, obviously there is, we can agree that it's a carrot, but like, through language, you know, that objects have names once they discern them. And so you say, well, this, you know, like say it's a plant, but I can say it should have a name. I don't know the name of it, so I'm going to give it a name. And yeah, you could encounter someone later on and you could both come to agreement on what it's called, but there's nothing, you know, you're not blind to the fact it's a carrot.
Yes. And this process of giving a name, of course, enters us into something interesting for the botanist, doesn't it? Because the botanist, in a way, has to be able to distinguish the carrot before it gives the carrot a name. The carrot acanensis, you know, that particular carrot. So we're dealing with a level of language where that sort of naming is already occurring within language, and it's not disclosing in quite the way that water was disclosed to Helen Keller, because we're just refining our disclosure with these acts of naming.
But you know, the appearance of something and something having a name being a unitary event. Something can appear to me without having a name, but I know that it should have a name.
Yes.
And so it's up to me then to give it a name.
Yes.
And that's not a cyclical thing, that's a unitary thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the botanist, for instance.
Yeah.
Recognizes that this is a thing, but it must have a name.
Yeah.
I'm interested.
Yes,
in
no, because but that kind of naming is a sort of a designating, isn't it? It's more designating
yeah.
than disclosing,
yeah.
Because the thing it actually has already disclosed
yeah.
itself within your rough and ready existing language capacity,
yeah.
and then you designate it
yeah.
more finally because you realise that we're lacking any term to do the designating, but it's already manifest.
Yeah.
Do you think we know ourselves before we know our name? I'm just thinking, like, I get a sense of, the, you know, distinguishing the me and the not me from very early age, and you, me.
Yeah, yeah.
Me.
No, I funnily, I've been...
And then when does this notion that this feeling that I'm actually something become connected to something that has a name. I think, and then I think when children start to speak, they don't say I or me, they say Maria.
Yeah, but I have the strong feeling that I was, you know, that my mum and dad used to, and I don't want you continuing this. They used to call me Boo Boo. Yes. Yes. I reckon Boo Boo was my first name.
And until I stopped responding to it.
Yeah. It was which was quite early on, I would imagine. Yes, I'm not. Yes.
Yeah.
Fifi.
Is little daughter in French.
Yeah. So I have the sense how it is in that world. I'm still in that world with Nicolette. We've got many names, haven't we? There are
Keep
yeah.
Presenting.
Yeah.
My kids get really annoyed with all the names
yeah.
that I call them, and they just, what the hell was that? And it's just come out of something.
Yes.
Ooh, a loving name.
Because there's something you were talking about there, which I was looking at this week myself, which is this sort of the me and the not me, which I think is very. I can almost imagine a single-celled creature having that sort of some kind of basic sense of its boundary.
Mm.
Do you know that I think that comes very basic.
Mm.
There's a certain, it's to do with one's intentionality. You know, there's a certain domain where your intention is an action, and there's no gap. You know, my intention to move my hand, there's no gap. And that's I think that's a sort of the basis of this idea of me. There's a kind of a domain where just to intend it occurs. And then there's this other domain where just to intend the table moves, it's not responding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even before language is disclosed, you have a sense of that agency. Do you know that very basic agency?
Is it because you haven't got the capacity developed to move that
table? But you see there's a lag.
Mm-hmm.
I can move the table, but it takes time.
No,
whereas,
if you were able to do it
kinesthetically.
If I could just move the world around like I can move my hand, then I'm in my imagination. That's what my imagination is.
Japanese martial art, you say?
No. Let's go back. What I mean is if the whole world, not just I manage to move a cup on the table a fraction of an inch, I mean that for you to feel that sense of agency over the whole world, you'd have to be able to change anything anywhere at any time.
It takes time to learn.
Yeah. No, it takes time. No, it takes time to learn to move your arm, right?
Yeah, so, if you're going to move the universe.
Yes. So, I think if you got to the point where you, where everything in your entire experience was utterly at your own, your intention was to change something, was is the changing of whatever you intended, then you'd no longer encounter any other being.
You'd
be everything. That would be the end of you encountering any other, wouldn't it?
Maybe you'd be living in the world of disclosure.
you just have lost it. You'd have lost the distinction whereby something can disclose itself.
But we as humans are able to do both, John, aren't we?
Oh yeah, yeah. We can head back in there. We can head back in there, and but we're still constrained. You know, Terry Pratchett? We can't imagine the colour of magic. You know, we're stuck with our dimensionality of colour. You can't say, oh, I think I'll just get a new one beyond purple. You know, we're still constrained in a way. With us, with the dimensionality of our senses, so we're not like God, who said, "Let there be colour." Yes.
Well, I read something on colour about people. How true this is or not. At a certain point in our development, we're not able to distinguish. You're not able to see certain colours that we can see nowadays.
You mean
as a human race?
Well, are you thinking of the research that's looked into that different languages don't have the same colour words as we do?
No, as a human race, I don't know how many years ago, but that we started off with a much lesser color spectrum that our eyes were actually able to see, process.
So it's to do with the structure of the cones in the retina.
I guess so, yeah. Because I mean, colors would have been more limited because there were less things and they were mainly nature based. Maybe therefore we didn't have to see so many colors. Maybe that developed with more colours coming into the world.
So I'd like to see the Nature paper that says that, because I doubt it. I do doubt it.
We both read it. That's enough proof. Come on.
Yeah. Well, no, because you know it's not to do. You know, chickens have got far greater colour discrimination than we have.
I guess so.
And they were certainly around a long time before we were.
Yeah.
Can I come back to the current radio, your camera?
Yeah.
Were you saying when you were explaining about a carrot that there was some disclosure? I mean, the carrot was just a clock, it wasn't a carrot because there was no word for it. There was some disclosure that arrived which then stimulated the production of a word of designation for carrot. And then sometime later, perhaps, using the word of the designation, you get a further disclosure. So it's like a circular process.
I wasn't thinking about that.
I thought it was implying what you said.
No, because I'm implying somehow that we're already in the world of disclosure, sometime around when we get language as a child, and after that, it's disclosed. All that happens is a refinement. Yes, but there's a huge transformation.
But what I was thinking was, when he comes across this carrot, it's just a plant, it's not a carrot.
And we're talking about our human being here.
Yeah,
you're not the rabbit.
A human being that comes across a carrot.
I'm saying, if you have language, then it's already disclosed as a being there.
Yes, as a being there. Yes, but not as a carrot being.
Yeah, we haven't got the right word for it.
Right,
yeah,
right. So it's already an identifiable being because of disclosure.
Yes.
Well, before language, in other words.
Not before.
You're
well,
saying that
well,
that
before.
Actually being able to
well,
a
no.
new word is predicated upon it also already being disclosed.
But
But I'm, we're talking about, yes, but
then
not
that counts as what you're saying.
Not in the original moment of the Helen Keller getting water.
Yeah.
That's the moment where there was no disclosure before the word and no word before the disclosure.
So
they,
what about the carrot? Is there no disclosure of a carrot as opposed to just general vegetation until there's the word carrot? And how comes he actually needs the word carrot if there's no disclosure of a carrot? Why didn't you stay with vegetable?
Well, most of us, at a certain level, we develop our language because of some action. I mean, we get to carrot because when we're wandering down the supermarket aisle, we distinguish it from a parsnip because we like the taste of a carrot, and we don't like the taste of a parsnip. So there's quite practical reasons why we distinguish. And if we were indifferent,
so you're saying the entity is already disclosed. The functionality of that entity pushes towards designating it with a word. And this all happens before you've got a word carrot to enlighten us on the disclosure of a carrot.
But you
see what I mean? I'm saying the whole thing is.
I do see what you mean. Okay. You're thinking that language is developing as we go along, so to speak. We encounter things we don't have names for, and then we give things names, and that's a kind of a model for how language develops. Yes, and so I'm pointing back and saying, but we're looking at the original event of disclosure, not the refinement of language that comes later.
But this is a disclosure, isn't it? I mean, a vegetable suddenly becoming a carrot, which is quite different, quite unique.
No.
It's a disclosure. It's no different from having water on your hand, is it?
It is.
Water is not air.
No,
water is not air.
I think we're missing the point that the carrot,
yeah.
we take the name away, but that we have distinguished something here. It's disclosed. It's already disclosed, and then we look for a word.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that and so there's no, there's the carrot isn't disclosed by us finding the word.
Right. Yeah.
We've already been able to disclose it out of the language we already have.
No, but there's no word to say carrot. I mean, what have you done out of the words that you already have that doesn't take you?
No, no. I don't think you see that. Maybe. That all of experience shades off out of language. Right? How can I put this? We can't describe. We don't have the language to describe in utter detail that what's going on this table surface. Do you know every single thing, when you get down to a certain level of detail, it is what you see. Do you see our ability to distinguish with language gets so far, but then there's a whole lot more in our sensory experience that we see but we don't distinguish and we don't have words for? Yes?
Yeah.
And what we're talking about here is, but if you want to, you can extend language into those areas,
right.
Especially if you're an expert and you want to study something in great detail.
You extend it into those areas, but until you extend it into those areas, you can't say carrot and have a further disclosure of a carrot. You've already done the process, I'm saying it's circular. It doesn't start with language. It's actually a circular process.
I think I'm agreeing, but I'm wondering where did we say it was linear?
You kept saying that it's language is so central to disclosure, and I'm saying disclosure comes before language.
But if we read Heidegger and what he's saying and what Bortov is saying is that. It's not they're saying it is circular in that way, in that language is disclosure. There's no disclosure then language. There's no language then disclosure. But what we're talking about with the naming of the carrot, there is a linearity in it. Yes?
I think it's also worth kind of considering that for most of us, we learn an existing word, and at that point when we learn the word, there is this experience, the Helen Keller experience of here there is a thing, now there is a name for this thing, that thing is now distinguished for me, that the word now starts to disclose this thing for me, all of this. But there is the one person who invented the word and repeated it or said it to somebody else, and that's how the second person heard of it and had the experience of this distinction being made. So I think for the original person, the experience was more that something has emerged to him and then he named it. But for the other person, do you see what I mean?
But what we're looking at here with language is that as soon as language comes into being for us, the world comes into being for us. And then you have a world. With language you have a word. Once you get the idea of language, you get the idea of the world. And then within that, and this is what will happen as a child, we're assuming, whether we remember it or not. It's only distinguished in as far as you're able to distinguish the world, and as far as the language that's been given to you. But the essential thing is moving from not having a world to having a world, and then you're in language, and then the process of extending language is something else, you know, that we're talking now, which ends up with you the first time you see a carrot, and you don't have a word for it, but you have a world, and you have language, and you know the procedure whereby you can extend language to extend your ability to distinguish the world. But as soon as you see the whole thing here being, as soon as we're objectifying and thinking about this. Whereas the whole point of this is to get back to the sense of what the disclosure of language is in the moment that it's occurring. All right, we'll have coffee. I'm very optimistic that we're going to finish this lecture. Can I ask you to be back at 12:30? How about that? 15 minutes?